Good morning.
Good morning.
I was struck by a little, is this on? There we go, that's better. I was struck by a little point of connection earlier in the service when Stephen was talking about coming into Unitarian Universalism, even though it was a, it pinched his Sunday pickup soccer game. And that was the exact way that that I came in. I had a Sunday morning pickup soccer game, which I ever so reluctantly loosened my grasp upon in order to begin attending church and exploring our religious journey. So that was that warmed my cockles of my heart. It's good to be back with you. It's been a few years since I was back here. It was coming on a yearly basis for several years, and we got out of that rhythm. But anyway, it's great to see you again and thriving, and may continue. You know, you hear a lot of talk these days about the moral decay of our society. And not infrequently, this tragic development is attributed largely to the diminishment of the role of the Ten Commandments in our culture. In particular, the prohibition against posting the Ten Commandments in public schools and in, say, courthouses is cited as a key factor in our decline. This, I confess, surprises me, since the moral problems that are usually the prime focus of these lamentations about the lack of Ten Commandments are not even mentioned in the Ten Commandments. The last time I looked, there were no commandments against premarital sex, or welfare, or drugs, or homosexuality, or divorce, and none requiring the veneration of military service, all of which are the sort of signs of moral decay that are supposed to be fixed by the posting of the Ten Commandments. In any case, I don't like the Ten Commandments as a basis for social morality, and not because the list of requirements and prohibitions isn't long enough. Besides the fact that several of them are strictly matters of religious piety, have no other gods, keep holy the Sabbath, have no graven images, and so forth, a more fundamental problem is what they fundamentally are, which is commandments. Thou shalt this and thou shalt not that. It's based on a model of domination. An authority figure in charge and everybody else bound to obey. Why do this and not that? Well, because God said so. Or more precisely, because there is an ancient book which says that Moses said, God said so. It's like the child asking the parent why they must put away their toys. And the parent says, because I said so. Or, because if you don't, I'm going to whip your behind. Now, there may be times when that's the best a parent can do. And there are certainly times when the infinite regression of why has got to be cut short. But if because I said so is mostly the kind of response a child gets, then what they learn is that behavior guidelines are essentially a matter of the powerful imposing their will and desires upon the weak. Such a child may comply, but only so long as they view themselves as weak and enforcement as certain. It doesn't work that well in a family, and it works even less well in a society. For centuries, defenders of orthodoxy have complained about how secularism and liberal religion undermine the fear of God and give human depravity unrestrained license. They seem to think that it's either their exact way or unbridled hedonism, limited only by civil law enforcement. Right? People will just do anything except what the police stop them from doing, which they rightly point out is never enough to make society decent and livable. The idea is that if there are not absolute rules enforced by an omniscient and omnipotent ruler, then anything goes. Now, I have to admit, I do sometimes hear a sort of reasoning which goes, well, maybe that's true for you, but I have a different view, and so that's not true for me. As though morality is nothing but opinion or preference. Now, having shaken loose the moorings of authoritarian morality, some fail to see any other moral scheme and so fall back on arbitrary preference. It's either an absolute authority or it's nothing but preference. See that kind of? That does happen sometimes. I observe that it's not true that anything goes. There are lots of things that one might find appealing and which one might get away with, but which turn out nonetheless to destroy peace of mind, to harm relationships, and to take the joy out of life. We must each make our own moral choices, but we don't make up the laws of the moral universe any more than a different opinion about gravity will make a stone fly up when you let it go. I believe there is a natural moral order, that there's a systematic relationship between moral choices and experiential consequences. And there's a Buddhist notion that I found very helpful in making sense of this, the concept of skillful means. They talk about skillful means, and that refers to an action or a choice which truly leads to happiness and well-being. Skillful. It's a skillful means to the end. For instance, to forego a third helping of ice cream might be considered skillful. A skillful choice. And the choice to eat that third helping might be considered unskillful. That's because, although eating the ice cream might yield a certain pleasure. Oh, yeah, right? While you're eating it, it feels good. And although there might be an urge to do it, hey, that's my preference. And although you might be of the opinion that it should be okay, nothing wrong with eating ice cream. Nevertheless, it might end up leading to misery of various sorts. Knowing the relationship between actions and their consequences and making choices for well-being, that is wisdom, is it not? Choice has moral consequences, and the better we learn to deal with that, the better off we and everyone around us will be. And here's a story I love. It seems there was a man out on a lake in a small rowboat. And he was minding his own business when he noticed a somewhat larger boat coming his way. And he cried out, "Hey, look out! You're going to crash into me!" But the other boat continued in its approach. And he says, "Hey, turn aside! You're going to hit me!" The other boat made no change and continued on, and boom! Rammed into the side of his boat and almost knocked him overboard. Well, the man was livid, cursing and screaming as the other boat bounced off and careened off to the side when he saw that there was no one in the other boat. In Buddhist morality, it's not a question of obeying or disobeying an authoritarian parental figure. Neither can there be an appeal for an exemption. Like, I don't know if that's the rule, but just, you know, just this once, you know. And there's no making excuses. Buddhist morality gets God out of the other boat. It's like if you drop a glass and it breaks. You might be upset, but you don't feel like you're being punished for dropping the glass, do you? Nor do you plead with it to not be broken. Nor do you go on and on about how unfair it is. You don't bargain with or blame the law of gravity. It just is, and you deal with it. Or if you do blame the law of gravity, well, we all acknowledge that that's rather neurotic. The Buddhist moral system assumes that everybody is striving for well-being, and that there are more and less skillful ways of going about that. Right? Everybody wants to be well, happy, satisfied. But our actions sometimes lead toward that kind of outcome, and sometimes not so much. Sometimes very much the opposite. In an interesting parallel, you might be aware that the Hebrew term, widely translated as sin, means at root to miss the mark, like as in shooting an arrow, to miss the mark. To miss the mark is unskillful. Whereas to hit the mark is skillful. Now, I want you to know that this pragmatic and essentially humanist moral approach of Buddhism is not a modern American reinterpretation, but is deeply rooted in the Buddhist tradition. I quote here from a central Buddhist scripture dealing with ethics, in which the Buddha is instructing his own son, Rahula. And listen to the careful and precise reasoning the Buddha employs. He says, "If you, Rahula, are desirous of doing a deed with the body, you should reflect on that deed thus. That deed of my body that might conduce to harm of self, and that might conduce to the harm of others, and that might conduce to the harm of both, this deed is unskilled. Its yield is anguish. A deed of the body like this, Rahula, is certainly not to be done by you. If you, Rahula, while reflecting thus, should find that deed which I am desirous of doing with the body is a deed that would conduce neither to the harm of self, nor to the harm of others, nor to the harm of both. That deed is skilled. Its yield is happiness. A deed like this, Rahula, may be done by you." The Buddha's instruction then goes on to repeat that whole litany with respect to deeds of speech and deeds of the mind. Even choices made in the privacy of our own consciousness and not acted out physically. All of them should be reflected upon in the same way, says the Buddha. He goes on to describe the same kind of reflection upon the deed in question while it is being performed, and reflecting on that after it has been performed to see whether it might be wisely repeated. You see, each person must reflect and make their own determination. But guidance is offered about how to do that. What is a good way to reflect? The Buddha's answer: reflect on whether this choice will conduce to harm of self or harm of others. Now, whether a choice will conduce to harm of self or others may be difficult to discern fully. But it's a very different thing from just saying, "Well, I want to do it," and thinking that's the end of the question. And it's a very different thing also from consulting a list of rules and seeing whether this thing that I'm thinking of is prohibited. Buddhism offers more than just guidance about how to reflect, though, because we don't always see the full implications of our actions, and we often kid ourselves for short-term pleasure. Oh, you know, that won't be a problem, right? Because I want to do it. We kid ourselves. They also offer more specific guidance in the form of precepts, and that's very interesting to me. Now, I've often heard the Buddhist precepts described as like the Buddhist Ten Commandments. It's true, they are both lists, and so they're alike in that way. And there is a certain amount of overlap in the content of them, so they're alike in that way. But what an essential difference in tone and context. Rather than thou shalt this and thou shalt not that, the Buddhist precepts are promises undertaken voluntarily by one who wishes to attain, move toward liberation of the spirit, and who decides to follow the advice of an expert, the Buddha. They're not imposed on anyone. So the precepts begin with the phrase, I vow to abstain from XYZ, or translated a little differently, I undertake the rule of training to refrain from XYZ. I really like it. To me, that puts the finger right on it. So the precepts are five in number. I undertake the rule of training to refrain from killing. Sounds familiar from the Ten Commandments, right? Thou shalt not kill. To refrain from taking that which is not given. Kind of like, you know, not stealing, but kind of a bit more fulsome. Refrain from taking that which is not freely given. Refrain from sexual misconduct. Corresponds to the adultery commandment, but it's more fulsome. Refrain from false speech, which in a way sounds just like the one about bear not false witness, but it's far more fulsome. False speech in general, not just bearing false witness, which is a very specific and legalistic kind of rule. And the fifth one is different from those others. Refrain from taking intoxicants which induce heedlessness. And in some sort of American, more liberal, they don't want to rule out intoxicants altogether. So they say taking intoxicants to the point of inducing heedlessness. Because it's the heedlessness is the objective of this, right? That it's already an unskillful act to do something which is not harmful in itself, but which is likely to lead to choices down the road which might be harmful, right? So it's somewhat unskillful to take that first step to lead yourself down the primrose path by inducing heedlessness or bad judgment in yourself. Now, it's fascinating to compare the Ten Commandments and the precepts in their details, you know, the similarities and the differences. That would be another whole day's worth of reflection. But what I really like to emphasize here is the difference in form. It's so essential. I undertake the rule of training. It's a free will act. The voluntary nature of the precepts is made doubly clear by the fact that ordained monks commit to an expanded set of precepts, including refraining from entertainments, refraining from eating after midday, and refraining from all sexual activity. For them, all sexual activity would be sexual misconduct in that context. These extra constraints for the monks are not undertaken because those things are considered to be evil, but because they interfere with the goal of cultivating the special qualities of mind that are so valued in Buddhism. It's just the same as when an Olympic athlete follows stricter discipline than the casual sports enthusiast or the spectator. To be a spectator, you don't need to follow a strict diet and get up at 6 in the morning, right? But if you want to be an Olympian, you do. Violating the precepts, once having undertaken them, is frowned upon. But it's perfectly okay for a monk to renounce their vows, to make their vows, and then unmake their vows, and return to lay life. There's no dishonor in that. It's not like they're disrobed. They take their vows, they untake their vows. It's all good. Everybody's happy. The Buddha was emphatic that the precepts are to be employed in the cause of liberation and not to become an oppressive orthodoxy. For instance, if a monk needed to take food after midday because of health reasons, that was permitted. It wasn't made into like, oh, it was a terrible sin. No. If it's necessary for well-being, which is the point, then you may do. Now, of course, you can't make a game of it and renounce my vows in the afternoon, and then I go out all night partying, and then in the morning I renew my vows. You can't, just the same as you can't go out and party all night and neglect your training and expect to do well in the Olympics. Even if the coach doesn't catch you in your carousing, you're just not going to do that well. It's not about rules, it's about how life works. Now, you know, some choices just naturally lead to peacefulness, confidence, open-heartedness, and real joy. Other choices tend to lead to regret, shame, confusion, or bitterness. The precepts offer guidance about the natural moral order, the relationship between actions and consequences. It's like stepping on a rake. Right? Hey, I wouldn't step on that rake if I were you. Oh, I see what you mean. Right? No hard feelings. It's not a power struggle. You don't argue with the rake or feel picked on because it struck you. You've stepped on a rake and you have experienced the result. It seems clear that the thing to do is to learn to be careful, not to step on rakes, and also not to leave them lying around for others to step on, if that's in your power. You don't waste your time yelling at an empty boat. How dare you do that? Oh, there's nobody there. Another bit from Buddhist scripture. The Buddha here is responding to a request for advice, instructing the residents of a certain city, the Kalimas. He says, "What do you think, Kalimas? Does greed appear in a person for their benefit or their harm?" And the Kalimas answer, "For their harm, venerable sir." Kalimas, being given to greed and being overwhelmed and vanquished mentally by greed, this person takes life, steals, commits adultery, and tells lies. They prompt another to do so. Will that be for their harm and ill? Yes, it will, venerable sir. And then the Buddha followed that same line of inquiry for hate and delusion, each time asking, "What do you think, Kalimas?" And he goes on saying, "Come, do not go upon what has been acquired by repeated hearing, nor upon tradition, nor upon rumor, nor upon what is in a scripture, nor upon surmise, nor upon an axiom, nor upon specious reasoning, nor upon a bias toward a notion which has been pondered over." I love that one. In other words, like, I've been thinking that, therefore, it must be right. Don't go upon that. Do not go upon another's seeming ability. Oh, they seem so smart, right? They must be right. Do not go upon the consideration, this monk is our teacher. Authority. Kali Mas, when you yourselves know these things are bad, these things are blamable, these things are censured by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to harm and ill, then abandon them. And when you yourselves know these things are good, these things are not blamable, these things are praised by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to benefit and happiness, then enter in and abide in those. And so what do you think, Unitarian Universalists? Is this good advice? And what do you think? Does harsh speech conduce to peaceful relations and a calm heart? Or is it more likely to yield agitation and resentment? Does reckless sexuality conduce to deep fulfillment? Or does it yield confusion and hurt? Does blowing off your commitments conduce to freedom, as you might like to think at certain moments? Or does it yield lost confidence and limited opportunity? What do you think, Unitarian Universalists? Do mercy and forgiveness bring relief to a troubled heart? Do habits of moderation promote clarity of mind and relationships of trust? Are there ways to be exuberant and celebrate life without harm or regret? We certainly don't provide you the answers to all these questions, but I think they are the right sorts of questions. By listening, and by observing, and by experiencing firsthand, we must learn. And before we have learned all, we must still proceed in humility. Right? We've got to make choices before we're completely certain what will be the outcomes, what will be the yield. But if we ask ourselves wise questions, we'll do much better. The opportunity is ours. The consequences will be ours. And so I hope you are skillful, my friends. Let us take a moment now to meditate in the sanctuary of our hearts. As we breathe quietly together, I invite you to listen to your own innermost depths. Take counsel with the wisest parts of your being. So we have just a brief moment for discussion. It might be that one or two of you have a reflection from your heart that arises out of what I have shared this morning. Is there something that you think might be good to share with our gathering this morning?
I got comfortable with the idea of God again when I said God is natural law, and that includes the moral part, the emotional part as well. So all of the things that, and it was nice to hear you talk about them in some detail. Thank you.
Yeah, comfort with God as the moral law of the natural universe, as embedded as being the natural universe, is just exactly what I'm talking about. There's no real difference between that and what I'm trying to say. Thank you.
Another Buddhist analogy or metaphor describing kind of what you're talking about is sowing seeds of planting seeds that will grow and that are for good, or planting seeds with maybe a unskillful mean of like drinking heavily or something like that will grow into something completely different. So the consequence may not be known right away, but eventually it will come to flower.
Yeah, seeds that our actions plant seeds. As an image, it's certainly a good one in Buddhism, and very much what I'm talking about, right? So harsh speech, like violent, saying something violent and hurtful, while it may be gratifying to the sort of self-righteous ego at a moment, I want to lash out, but it plants a seed of bitterness and resentment, probably on the part of the other person, and then very likely shame and regret. Myself too, and plants that seed. Maybe just one more. Thank you.
I like seeing the rake as a great teacher.
The rake as a great teacher.
My right to experience the rake.
Seeing the rake as a great teacher.
Right.
Until I choose the rake, I have a taste of it.
Right. And what is the. What is the critical element there? It's like, when is the student ready for the teacher, right?
No.
When the rake hits me in the face, will I draw wise conclusions from that? Or will I go some other way and say, oh, that wasn't my fault. I didn't do it. Right? That would be refusing to learn the lesson of the rake in that instance. But if we go, and even if someone left the rake there, right? So you could run with the blame. Even so, right? Wisdom will say, I'm on the lookout to avoid stepping on these kinds of rakes in the future. Yeah. I think we better conclude here. We've got to finish up this service. So, yeah. Thank you so much for the spoken and unspoken reflections of your heart.